From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Gulf War is supposed to have erased the bitter memories of the war in Vietnam. But 16 years after the end of that war, we still have a trade embargo against Vietnam. On today's Fresh Air, James Fallow says we're punishing Vietnam for having won the war. Also today, teaching language to someone who lived his whole life without it. And film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews the new courtroom drama, Class Action. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Kurdish revolt in northern Iraq is becoming more visible. Reports tonight from Turkish cities on the Iraqi border say that Kurds seem to have made gains against Iraq. The claims bolster assessments from Kurdish leaders in Europe and the Middle East that the Kurds have more territory in their control than any time in the past 65 years. John Hockenberry reports from Ankara.
The Turkish news agency Anatolia has reported that villagers from the Turkish village of Habur have seen Kurdish rebels inside Iraq firing their weapons in the air in celebration. One unconfirmed report, but one widely related among Turkish villagers, says that the Kurdish flag was seen flying inside Iraq. Habur village is situated exactly on the Turkish-Iraqi frontier. The red and green Kurdistan flag was said to be flying at the border post, although there has been no official Turkish assessment that the border is now in the hands of Kurdish rebels. Kurdish rebels in Damascus say that the anti-Iraq forces control the entire border region, while there have been conflicting reports about the status of Mosul, the largest city in the region. A Kurdish rebel leader quoted in Paris has said that the rebels now control perhaps three-quarters of Iraqi Kurdistan. This is John Hockenberry in Ankara.
The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said today that the U.S. military is reconsidering the role of U.S. combat reserves. General Colin Powell said it was clear that reserve units will require more training before they can join active duty troops in battle. The reevaluation comes after military officials were unable to get National Guard troops battle-ready in time to fight in the Persian Gulf War. A senior Defense Department official said later that the Army may have to reconstitute its rapid deployment force, which is now made up of two active duty brigades and one reserve brigade. The Air Force Chief of Staff, Merrill McPeak, says the outcome of the Persian Gulf War was determined within the first hours of the air campaign against Iraq. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
In what was billed as the Pentagon's most comprehensive briefing on the air war to date, General McPeak said the coalition air force dropped 88,500 tons of bombs over Iraq and Kuwait during the 43-day Gulf War. McPeak said the critical period was the first few hours of the air campaign beginning January 17th, when more than 2,000 Allied planes began their six-week air offensive.
And it was a very heavy attack, very precisely delivered, and in my judgment, the Iraqi Air Force never recovered from this opening attack.
General McPeak said well over 700 Iraqi warplanes were destroyed or fled to Iraq during the war. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The stock market posted another small loss today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 4 points to close at 2,948.27. Declines led advances by a margin of 2-1 in heavy trading of 238 million shares. This is NPR. Secretary of State James Baker voiced support today for Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev and his efforts at political and economic reform. After a meeting with the Soviet president today, Baker said that Gorbachev has taken steps to defuse tensions in the Baltic republics. He said that Gorbachev told him that mediators have been appointed to resolve disputes with secessionist leaders in Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. Following the meeting with Gorbachev, Secretary Baker had dinner with the reformist mayors of Moscow and Leningrad, as well as some leaders of the Soviet republics who've been highly critical of the Soviet president. A Los Angeles grand jury handed down indictments today against four police officers for the beating of black motorist Rodney King. The indictments are for crimes ranging from falsifying police reports to assault. Kitty Feldy of station KLON reports.
Three patrol officers are named in the suit, as well as the supervising sergeant on the scene the night of the beating. Assistant District Attorney Terry White says even though Sergeant Stacy Kuhn may not have used his own baton on Rodney King, he is still charged with assault with a deadly weapon.
Principals can be either those persons that have actively and directly participated in the commission of the crime or those persons that aided and abetted in the commission of the crime. Under that particular theory, under aiding and abetting, Sergeant Kuhn would be a principal and be liable for the assault with a deadly weapon and the other charges.
Attorneys for the four officers refused to enter pleas for their clients, choosing instead to challenge a new California law that allows prosecutors to bypass preliminary hearings and go directly to the grand jury. For National Public Radio, this is Kitty Feldy in Los Angeles.
A Chicago jury declined to recommend the death penalty today in the case of a drug dealer who was found guilty of a drug-related killing. The case of drug dealer Alexander Cooper was the first to be tried under a federal law extending capital punishment to drug-related offenses. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After our quick and decisive military victory over Iraq, President Bush said, "The specter of Vietnam has been buried forever in the desert sand of the Arabian Peninsula." But 16 years after the war, we haven't yet normalized relations with Vietnam. America is still leading an embargo against the country. James Fallow suggests the embargo is our way of punishing Vietnam for having won the war. It's the subject of his article in this month's edition of The Atlantic magazine. Fallows is The Atlantic's Washington editor. His most recent book, More Like Us, is about Japan, and he's now writing a book on the future of East Asia. Fallows also comments on the East for NPR's Morning Edition. James Fallows, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Nice to talk with you again, Terry.
So why do you think it's really our intention to punish Vietnam for having won the war?
I think it may be a little more perverse and a little more complicated than that. The case I try to make in this article about the embargo against Vietnam is that there are two places it hurts. One is Vietnam, of course, because the embargo is sufficient to keep the World Bank from building electric systems there and to keep sort of the normal development from taking place. So it's sufficient to punish Vietnam. It also is sufficient to punish us because basically, no one else is deterred by this embargo. And you see huge signs for Daewoo, you know, the Korean firm, and Japanese goods all over Vietnam. And the Italians and the French are there doing a rapid business. And I think what's happened is that from a purely rational point of view, it'd be very hard to make the case that 16 years later, which we should be having this embargo on Vietnam. But from an emotional point of view, no one can stand to face this subject again. I mean, the word Vietnam connotes such unpleasantness and torment and suffering for most Americans that for politicians in particular, who would have to change this law to remove the embargo, it's a completely no-win proposition. They can say Iraq for the next 100 years and people will cheer, but if you say Vietnam, no one even wants to think about it, so this perverse policy just kind of limps along.
But officially, the policy is to punish Vietnam for its violation of human rights. Right?
Yes, and it's the official rationale has evolved over the years. This Trading with the Enemy Act embargo was first slapped on against North Vietnam when we were fighting them in the 60s, and then applied to the whole country. And since 1979, it's been linked mainly to the affairs in Cambodia. Mm-hmm. Vietnam invaded there. Everybody condemned them. And now, you know, 12 years after that, there's still pressure on Vietnam to get out of Cambodia. The difficulty here is that, you know, the Cambodian negotiations are, if anything, more complicated than those in the Middle East. It's just this impossible snarl of factions competing with each other, and most other governments think that Vietnam is now not the major bad guy there. If there's a major bad guy, it's probably China for keeping the Khmer Rouge going. And so that's the official rationale, that Vietnam is being so bad in Cambodia we can't have any dealings with them. But I think there is a real emotional rationale below that.
So what are the terms of the embargo against Vietnam?
There are several. It's not possible for the government to forbid Americans to go there. For example, I spent the month of November there, and there are about some 10 or 15,000 Americans who go there each year. But under regulations from the Treasury Department and the State Department and the Commerce Department, basically everything else involving the U.S. and Vietnam is supposed to be prohibited. You can't make a telephone call to Vietnam from the U.S. You know, uniquely among the countries in the world, you can't call from the U.S. to Vietnam. If you're from any place except the U.S., you can use a Visa card in Vietnam, but Americans can't because Treasury Department regulations say the banks can't pay. In theory, nothing from Vietnam is supposed to be imported here. the U.S. has vetoed World Bank and IMF collaboration or interactions with Vietnam. So, and all these sort of economic impediments are, along with a complete lack of diplomatic relations. In Hanoi, there are embassies from basically every country, every major country except the U.S. So to the extent it's possible to think that Vietnam doesn't exist, that's the intention of the policy.
Vietnam is still trying to rebuild itself after the war. What effect is this embargo having on those rebuilding attempts?
It has an effect we couldn't really rationally wish, because it is so harmful. Most developing countries in the world, including ones that we might object to in their policy even more than Vietnam, including Iraq, you know, before 6 months ago, rely on international agencies to get these big capital projects going. It's only through the World Bank that a poor country can build a road system, can build electric systems, can have food research and things like that. Because of the U.S. and Japanese veto on World Bank projects and IMF loans to Vietnam, this basic infrastructure can't get going. And so when you go there now, you see a lot of people who have the same kind of ferocity of will that the U.S. remembers from Vietnam, and working very hard in small-scale enterprises, but the large-scale development of the country is really retarded below the level of all its neighbors.
What about the effect this is having on American businesses? American businesses must be losing out on potentially lucrative contracts in Vietnam.
I think this is the way the policy will change, if it does, because there, in Southeast Asia and Northeast Asia, including Japan and Korea, there is this sort of, you know, gold mine mentality among people who think that this is the chance to go in with no American competition whatsoever. There's an Australian businessman named Raymond Eaton, who's based in Bangkok, who goes around giving a speech basically every day to non-American audiences saying, this is your golden opportunity to get in without any competition from the U.S. Now, this has different shadings. For example, the Japanese in principle want to abide by the U.S. policy, this being sort of their main foreign policy goal, and so they discourage their companies from having overt involvement there. On the other hand, Japan is now surpassing the Soviet Union as the main exporter to Vietnam. Basically, all the manufactured goods there are either Japanese or Korean. Vietnam just gave some oil leases on a field that Mobil had discovered back in the old days of the war, and it went to a consortium of countries, not including the U.S. So I think this is what will finally get the policy changed, is complaints from U.S. business.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Fallows. He's the Washington editor for The Atlantic Magazine, commentator for NPR's Morning Edition, and author of a recent book about Japan and a forthcoming book about East Asia. Are there absurd but creative ways of circumventing this boycott, this embargo against Vietnam?
There are indeed. I talked to a very innocent seeming Vietnamese manager of a shipping company in Ho Chi Minh City, the former Saigon, who was explaining that most of his sales were to the U.S. And I said, well, you know, how can this be? There's this embargo. And he said, oh, well, of course, you don't understand. They ship everything to Vancouver, and all the papers are changed there. And the things that came from Vietnam or come from Hong Kong or China or some other, you know, desirable country like that. And then they go on to California from Vancouver. That's the way some of the trade takes place. You get into a game of phone tag sometimes. When I was arranging with the Vietnamese ministries to have this visit, I would have to send faxes to a friend of mine in Bangkok, who would then send it from her fax machine to the ones in Hanoi. And so it's a peculiar situation.
The American goal in the Vietnam War was to keep South Vietnam free from communism, but we bombed South Vietnam quite a bit. From 1962 to 71, the United States sprayed 55 million acres of South Vietnam with herbicides. That's about one-seventh of the country. And many of the tropical forests are just grass now because of these herbicides. Do you think that the United States has a responsibility to help rebuild South Vietnam, which we participated in the destruction of?
Well, this may sound very strange. I don't think that item is very high on the Vietnamese list of priorities now for a stranger sounding reason.
The forest?
The forest and in general. And the point I'm getting at here is that what we think of as the Vietnam War is now less important to the Vietnamese than it is to us. I mean, to us, it is this historic watershed that changed our economy and our idea of foreign policy, et cetera, et cetera. To them, the phase of fighting with the Americans was part of a long episode of fighting, with the Japanese before that and the French before that and the Chinese after it and the Cambodians after it. And there's been more or less constant warfare for a long time. And so the emotional content of this whole episode is much lower in Vietnam than it is in the U.S. Now, I'm sure it is a very poor country, and they would be happy for help they could get of any kind. There is a big conservation project underway called the Mekong River Project, which is supposed to do some of this reforestation work. Actually, the main threat to the forest now is not so much the defoliants from 15 or 20 years ago, but the timber companies that are in there operating much more rapidly than before. So I think from Vietnam's point of view, they're not looking so much for reparations as they foolishly asked 15 years ago from the Carter administration, foolish because it threw the negotiations off the course, but rather just normal commercial interactions. That's the main thing they want.
Well, you know, I raised the question about the responsibility to rebuild South
right.
Vietnam, thinking in part two about, well, do we have a responsibility to eventually help build Iraq?
Well, this is part of the perplexity of these whole subjects. I would suspect that the U.S. will give money to rebuild Iraq before it gives money to rebuild Vietnam.
Because we won.
Because we won.
Yeah.
Because we won. And we can afford to think about it again and afford to be magnanimous. It is one of the twists of our national character that Americans are much better winners than losers. The Japanese often say the reverse about themselves, that they were very good losers after World War II and are not such good winners in economic war. And then the reverse is, I mean, for the U.S., we are much more likely to behave like decent people if we don't feel threatened and feel like we won.
If you're just joining us, James Fallows is my guest, and he is the author of a book about Japan. He's the Washington editor for The Atlantic magazine and a commentator for NPR's Morning Edition. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. James Fallows is my guest. So what are some of your observations, having watched the United States win the war in Iraq and see it as something that would help erase the bitter taste of our loss in Vietnam?
I think there is part of this much-advertised cleansing effect that is good, I think. It is good to have the military be in high esteem in the public in general. I did a lot of reporting in the military in the late 70s when they were at their trough after Vietnam. That was a terrible situation for the country and for the Army, where people did not have any pride in what they were doing because they felt despised by the country as a whole. And so it's good. One sub-reason why it's good to have the military feeling better, I think, is that many of the values that people of every political stripe would like more of in America as a whole are now best exemplified in the military. It is racially the most open part of American society. It is becoming much more open between men and women. It's one of the parts of American society where sort of the me ethic and the 80s money ethic has not taken hold, because it can't, where people need to have some team spirit and things like that. So I think that is good. It is probably good for the U.S. to feel that it's not just declining and collapsing in all fronts. However, I think the sort of triumphal reaction of the last several weeks is dangerous for several reasons. One is, this was a very peculiar kind of war we fought. If you happened to have signed up for the military before the war started, or to have signed a contract to go into the reserves, then you were affected by this war. You were in Saudi Arabia for a long time, you were exposed to risks, your family was disrupted, etc. If you weren't part of that group, this war did not touch you at all. You know, we didn't pay for it, the gasoline prices didn't go up, we didn't have to conserve anything, we didn't have to do anything that people normally do during wars. And so to act as if this were a tremendous demonstration of national resolve, it seems to me wishing that something were true rather than having it be true. I would have felt better if the president had said, okay, we've shown that we can do things in a military way. We know there are other things that we need to do. And so today I'm having a national defense gasoline tax. It'll pay first for this war, and then it'll pay for all the money we've been borrowing. We're going to have other things which everybody knows we need to do, but we've been waiting for some kind of prod. And so that, I think, there's a danger of thinking that, you know, all our national woes are washed away. Just one other point, that Great Britain, you know, it has basically won every war it's gotten into since its involvements with the U.S. 200 years ago, with a few minor exceptions. But basically, it's constantly won its military engagements and yet steadily diminished in its sense of sort of power in the world. And this can be an example to us all.
Do you think that the countries in the coalition will be trying to punish Japan for contributing only money to the war?
I don't know. I think that everybody in Japan is asking exactly that question. One way to answer it is that I spent a lot of time following the debate about this money, and 99.5% of the arguments about whether or not Japan should spend money had nothing to do with Saddam Hussein. They had everything to do with public opinion in the U.S. That mm-hmm. is, how much money will be expected of us? How much money will it take so that we are not criticized? I think Japan has now come up with enough money. They're putting up in all, or they've promised in all, some $13 billion that I think that will look like a lot of money. On the other hand, I think their stance as an international leader has suffered. It's going to come in for severe reconsideration, because here you have the second most powerful economy in the world that simply was not able to participate and was not able to decide what to do, which is the distinction between it and Germany. I think that Germany decided and Japan couldn't decide through the months of this conflict what role it was supposed to play.
We know in terms of the Cold War, the comparison is always that the United States spent all of its money after World War II building up its military, and Japan spent its time and money building up its consumer industry, so Japan came out ahead economically. But in the war in the Middle East, the United States used that military that had been building up and is now kind of repositioning itself in the Middle East, and it stands to gain a lot more political power, not to mention a greater economic base. Does that make a case for the United States having been right in building up its military in the intervening years?
I think that if you wanted to argue sheer economic efficiency, it would be hard to say that the U.S. has come out ahead economically by what it's done. There is a more gimlet-eyed version of the same case you could make for the U.S. now, which is that the comparative advantage the U.S. has over Japan in sort of international rivalry now comes down to things like pop culture, which America dominates around the world. The higher education system, which is very attractive in the U.S., people come from around the world to go into our universities, and the military. That in Asia, what makes people pay attention to the U.S. is those things and the Seventh Fleet. The fact that the U.S. has ships every place and Japan does not. And I think in the Middle East is becoming part of the same thing. And so in a somewhat more hard-eyed calculation, we may say, well, as our relative economic power diminishes, one influence we retain is this diplomatic and military influence. And that is not Woodrow Wilson speaking, but I think it is the way the world now works.
I'm interested in hearing a little bit more about your recent trip to Vietnam. You were there in November. What are some of the things that you saw that really surprised you, that were really different from what you were expecting to see?
I'd been there about 3 years before that, and what struck me then is how poor the place was compared to anywhere else in Southeast Asia. The only place that was comparable to it was Burma. And in Burma, you have the feeling of a place that's just frozen in amber and hasn't stirred in a long, long time. In Vietnam, you had the sense of ambitious people with the lid on them, the lid mainly of their own system, but also the international isolation. In the 3 years since then, there has been a lot of change. 3 years since I first went there. The government is now preaching an East European-style liberalization, and so you see it in sometimes effective and sometimes pathetic ways. The pathetic way is that it looks to me as if everybody who has a house in Hanoi has tried to convert it into a nightclub. And so with this flickering power system, you see these little tiny 1-watt neon bulbs or little 1-watt Christmas tree-type bulbs around the window saying, you know, Café de Hanoi, and they all have, probably in all of Hanoi, there are maybe 1,000 VCR machines, each one of them in one of these little nightclubs. So people are literally selling Saigon beer to each other in these little nightclubs. There also is in the south of of Vietnam in the former Saigon, you see a lot of entrepreneurship now that you wouldn't have that I wouldn't have expected, and it's largely from the Taiwanese who are coming in and building new buildings. It has the standard kind of Asian construction style where a high-rise building is going up with bamboo scaffolding. You see these guys climbing on the bamboo, you know, with their toes holding on. So I guess it is surprising to see first what a great difference there is still between the south and north of Vietnam. They still seem like two different countries, and how business seems to be getting off the ground more in the south. I suppose the other thing that would be surprising to most Americans is to go to Hanoi and see how beautiful it is. It's essentially a French provincial city that I'm sure was bombed a lot, but it's not bombed in ways that are now visible. And it's a preserved French provincial city of the 1930s with people riding bicycles all around.
What's something you did in Vietnam that's really out of character for you, but you were in a different culture and you did it?
This is a little embarrassing, but...
oh, I'm glad I asked.
I went to the Club International in Saigon, which is, as I didn't fully realize before I went there, one gigantic whorehouse. You have these... Well, the light bulb started to go on in my mind when I walked into this place with the music going at 5,000 decibels, and there were probably 10 or 15 other Caucasian men in there like me, and maybe 20 or 30 Japanese or Korean-looking men, and about 5,000 young Vietnamese women, and the fee to get in there, which is, you know, I should point out that almost all commerce in Vietnam is denominated in dollars. You pay in U.S. dollars for everything you do, and it costs like $2 to get in, which is a lot of money in Vietnam. So I wondered, you know, gee, there's this prosperous middle class in Hanoi in Ho Chi Minh City of all these young women who can afford the $2. And gradually my synapses came into focus, and I realized what was going on. But that was something that was, I hasten to say, out of character for me, and I won't go on in my narrative, but it was interesting to see.
Okay. I have one last question for you. You've been studying Vietnam, Japan, other countries in the East. But having looked at Vietnam and Japan, you've looked at the aftermath of our wars against both countries. And I wonder if that's led you to think about how our war against Iraq was, in a military sense, very short, but that the political, economic, health after effect of this war might be very, very long lasting.
I wish I had thought to put it that way, because that's a very, very good way of putting it. The American wars in Japan and Korea were essentially the best things that happened to those countries. I mean, I think that is the conventional wisdom in both those places, and they cleared the decks in various ways, set the stage for phenomenal development. That was not the case in Vietnam for reasons we've been discussing, but yes, the aftermath goes on for a long time, and I'm sure will in the Middle East.
James Fallows, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thanks for giving me the chance.
James Fallows is the Washington editor for The Atlantic Magazine, a commentator for National Public Radio's Morning Edition, and author of the book More Like Us, which is about Japan, and author of a forthcoming book on the Far East. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Susan Schaller teaches American Sign Language. Her greatest challenge was teaching a 27-year-old deaf man who had no concept of language at all. Coming up, Susan Schaller on teaching language to a man without words. Also, Owen Gleiberman reviews Class Action, a new courtroom drama starring Gene Hackman and Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. U.S. military officials have moved some troops back to their most advanced position in southern Iraq. But a senior U.S. official denied the move was intended to pressure Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. NPR's Ann Garrels has more.
The return of U.S. troops to positions they had held deep inside Iraq coincided with the decision to keep U.S. troops in Iraq until there's stability within the country. The move also coincided with accusations by President Bush that by using helicopter gunships to put down the rebel insurrection, the Iraqis are violating the ceasefire agreement. The president has not said how he might respond if Iraq continues to violate the ceasefire terms. The Pentagon had said there is no threat U.S. troops would get involved in the insurrection, but questions were raised just why the troops had been ordered back. Marine Brigadier General Richard Neal insisted the military had moved the soldiers back to their positions in the Euphrates River Valley, not to pressure Iraq, but to ensure they could control the area pending a permanent ceasefire agreement. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
The Pentagon says that Allied planes dropped more than 88 tons of bombs on Iraq and Kuwait during the Persian Gulf War. According to U.S. military officials, U.S. jets dropped about 75% of the total bombs used by Allied attack planes and heavy bombs on Iraqi military targets. In Moscow, Soviet leader Gorbachev has urged the Soviet people to vote yes on a referendum to preserve the Union. In his plea, Gorbachev promised that the vote would bring renewal, not a return to the old order. But in a television speech, Boris Yeltsin, leader of the Russian Republic, called the vote confusing and misleading. Tim Huell of the BBC has more.
Mr. Yeltsin said the question on the ballot paper, whether to preserve a union of Soviet socialist republics, was vague and ambiguous. It avoided asking people directly whether or not they wanted socialism. If people voted yes, he said, the Kremlin would treat the result as approval of its current policies. If they voted no, it would be a signal to Mr. Gorbachev and his colleagues that those policies needed changing. Some radical leaders have called directly for a no vote, or for people to spoil their ballot papers. The result is that supporters of further reform have no clear guidance on how to vote. And Mr. Gorbachev will almost certainly win a resounding yes to the Union. The main hope of Mr. Yeltsin and his supporters is that voters will also say yes to a second question being asked within the Russian Federation, whether there should be a directly elected president of the republic.
Tim Huell reporting for the BBC. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 4 points to close at 2,948.27 on volume of some 238 million shares. Trading was heavy. This is NPR News. Yugoslav President Jovic has resigned in a protest against failure of the country's government to authorize military intervention in the country's civil unrest. Shortly before the move, military officials had indicated that they were getting ready to take some kind of action that would give it a role in running the nation. The Soviet Union has ruled out the extradition to Germany of former communist leader Erich Honecker. Deidre Berger has more.
A Soviet foreign ministry spokesman today conceded his government had taken Erich Honecker out of the country without approval by the German government. On Wednesday, Soviet authorities transferred him from a military hospital in East Berlin to a Moscow clinic. But the Soviets say the transfer was essential to improve the quality of health care for the 77-year-old, who has serious kidney and circulation problems. Bonn Foreign Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher told the German parliament the transfer was unacceptable and demanded the Soviets extradite the former leader to Germany. Justice officials have issued an arrest warrant for Honecker, whom they hold personally liable for the shoot-to-kill orders on the former inter-German border. But the Soviets claim Honecker's health condition is too fragile to allow his return to Germany. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
Washington and Albania have signed an agreement normalizing diplomatic relations after a period of some 57 years. A State Department official said that Washington is hopeful that Albania will carry out free and fair elections March 31st. When officials of the two countries met last May to talk about diplomatic ties, it marked their first official contact since the 1940s. This country's industrial production fell 0.8% last month, pushed down by drops in car and truck assemblies. Excluding cars and trucks, production fell 0.7%, about the same rate as it fell in the previous 3 months. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. As a teenager, Susan Schaller was drawn to the visual way deaf people communicate. Though she could hear, she became a teacher of American Sign Language. While working as an interpreter for deaf people in a reading skills class in California, Schaller met a 27-year-old illegal immigrant from Mexico. Not only was he deaf, he was illiterate. He had no concept of language at all. Schaller had to find a way to teach language to a man who had none. Schaller has written about this man, who she calls Ildefonso. Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet spoke with Schaller about her new book, A Man Without Words.
He had never spoken, or I should say communicated, with another human being in the way that we commonly, and most of us, almost all of us, do, which is using standard symbols, names that always mean the same day after day, which means that he had no way of understanding the world, anything that takes language to explain, such as politics, the things that we can't see, bureaucracy, absentee ownership, political entities such as the United States and Mexico were foreign to him. So he had no idea why he was arrested, if he was ever arrested as an illegal resident. He couldn't understand what was going on, the idea of a border, for example, a political border.
What were some of the ways that you could figure out that he had compensated in his life for things that he just didn't know about, because he had gotten by for 27 years?
After working with him for a while and partly seeing how he copied me, and which was one of the major barriers, I couldn't communicate because every time I brought up my hands to visually communicate with him, he would bring up his hands and try to copy me, which was the first and most obvious clue as to how he survived. He had survived by copying. He watched people work. If people pointed to a bucket and to a place to carry it to, I mean, he would figure out that he was being told to do something. So he could respond to visual orders, basically mime or acting something out, pointing. And even if he didn't understand what he was doing, oftentimes he survived by following people.
So he appeared in this class where you were teaching, and you wanted to teach him sign language and reading. But it didn't work for you to just show him a picture of a cat and then sign the word for cat or show him the written word for cat. And why didn't that work?
Well, as I said before, he echoed, a visual echo. He copied everything, so I couldn't get across the idea of listening, you know, to pay attention. He hadn't ever in his life been in the kind of dialogue that I was trying to perform. And the way I finally got through was to ignore him. And I realized that what struck me when I first saw him was that although he was scared, although he was withdrawn and confused, he studied everything. He just looked at everybody and what was going on, trying to figure out what was happening. And I should just interject, one of the most amazing things about him, I think, is that after 27 years, he kept trying to understand what was going on and had not given up. So I just thought, well, you know, he will study me. I just had faith, and I just ignored him, and I became the teacher and an imaginary student. And I just tried to teach this imaginary student the lesson about how the sign cat and the word C-A-T, and I should say he didn't know what a C or an A or a T was, but I think I was hoping he had a general association between this picture of a cat and this general shape, C-A-T. So I was using that along with the sign for cat and miming the creature cat and petting a cat And I went over and over about how this was a means of transferring the idea of Kat from my head to his head. And then I would become him, the imaginary student, and I would go up to the board and I'd start petting Kat. Like, oh, I get it, that's a cat. And then, of course, it would smear and I would be confused. Oh, that's not a cat. And then I would go back to the teacher and mime, no, that's not the cat, but the idea of a cat. And I would try to get it from my head to his head.
You continued working with him, and then one day he finally did get the connection between the written word cat and the picture of a cat. Can you describe that moment?
It was extremely exciting and happy, and it was also rather sad, because what happened was he just had the insight, everything has a name. So in that moment, it would be inaccurate to say that he understood language, because language is more than names, but the idea that everything had a name, that he could use it with other people besides me, and that it would, that name would exist tomorrow, it was just overwhelming. And he started pointing to everything in the room. And in the book, I describe it as if he had seen everything again for the first time. And it did seem like that. He was just scanning the room and pointing, what's this, what's this, what's this? And it was very exciting, and I gave him all the signs I could. And then he collapsed and started crying. And it's open to interpretation exactly what were his feelings, but my feeling at the time, my guess, was that he was overwhelmed also with the loss that he had missed out in 27 years. He had been, in a sense, a prisoner, left on the outside, that he could not join humanity because he didn't have the names that other people had.
So he began to realize how different he was, or what he was missing out on.
Yes, and I think, although he knew he was missing things, he didn't understand what deafness and hearing was. Being born deaf, deaf people don't, how would they understand what hearing is? And he, not having any education or exposure to other deaf people, knew that something was different. But unfortunately, I think he thought he was stupid for much of his life, that all of us, in a sense, were deaf, but we somehow figured out what we were doing on each other's lips. I mean, he didn't know what hearing and sound was. And he put a great burden on himself, you know, how are people communicating and why can't I figure it out? And so it was very sad, because instead of really being angry at the time that he saw that he had been kept away from these names, or names kept away from him, I think he was still filled with this idea that I was dumb, I couldn't figure out what was going on. And He's much less that way now, but for a long time, I think he was filled with anger, in a sense, at himself instead of others.
What were some of the things that he all along had understood about life that surprised you?
Oh, one of the things was just his relationship to the world and the way he thought about relating to the world. Early on, he explained to me in mime, or it seemed, it was a question, and again, there's a lot of guesswork with mime, but the best guess I could come up with was he's asking me, why are people so greedy? And then years later, when he had language, he did talk about how he would like to have his own little garden, his own little plot, and he thought that the reason there were wars and the reason that there was so much trouble in the world is that people weren't happy with just a little garden, that they wanted great big huge houses and gardens, and therefore there wasn't enough to go around. And I thought this was pretty amazing. I mean, he'd come up with this before language, and that's one example of how he was a little bit of a philosopher, even without language, and again, without feedback from other people.
Did you think about how he might have developed those ideas?
One thing, again, that distinguishes him from wild children and abused children is he had a loving family, a very close family, and although there wasn't communication in the sense of language, he had affection and physical communication. I'm sure he got enough hugs from a good Mexican family and he felt he belonged, and I think that made a big difference on how he was able to think about relating to the world and relating to friends and loved ones. And Ildefonso and his experiences really beg another question. How much do we learn without language? He learned an awful lot about, I think, relating to the world and perhaps even Mexican culture as opposed to Anglo culture. just by seeing and just by watching. And it is an interesting question. How much do we learn before we talk, or even after we talk and hear? How much do we learn just by seeing?
My guest is Susan Schaller. Her book is called A Man Without Words. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Susan Schaller is my guest. In your book, you describe a scene when you're at the school teaching and an old friend of yours happens to stop by. And he's deaf, and he met Ildefonso, and they just began communicating very quickly and easily. And after watching them, you felt that your hearing handicapped you. Why would you feel that way? What was going on in their communication?
An amazing thing that I saw when I first met deaf people, I felt as though I could see for the first time, that my eyes were in a sense opened, or that the window was much bigger. And again, when this deaf friend walked in and met Ildefonso and started talking to him, signing to him, I said, Cal, he doesn't know language. He's just learning his very first language. And he just, in a sense, almost ignored me or brushed me off and said, he didn't say anything, but it was just the attitude that, well, that's not that significant, and started communicating to him with mime and gestures. And Ildefonso, after a few moments, responded. And these two brains were very different than my brain, in the sense that they weren't dependent at all on sound to carry meaning, and they could easily use their body and face and arms and hands to describe anything. And as I mentioned in the book, that there wasn't any one symbol or gesture that Cal, my friend, came up with that I couldn't have thought of, but it was the speed. He did it so quickly and just automatically. And I felt handicapped because my hearing brain was dependent on words and sound. And even though I learned American Sign Language, I was a foreigner to this world, and I had to translate. I had to think very consciously, how do you communicate visually? And hearing people learning sign language, especially later in life, they really do have to cross a huge gulf. How do you use your eyes and this world of vision to communicate?
You also write that as you worked with deaf people, you began to realize that deafness is far more than an inability to hear, and that there's a unique culture of deaf people, which you were just talking about. So, can you tell us more about that?
One of the big differences between deafness and any other disability or loss of faculty is that it does immediately affect language. And even if we lose our hearing later in life, we suddenly have communication problems with the people around us. Deafness is immediately a language barrier. So deaf people, signing deaf people, see themselves as a linguistic minority. They don't see themselves as handicapped or disabled. Obviously, if everyone is deaf and signing, or you don't have to be deaf, but signing, then they would have no handicap. And I think in general, and many linguists say this about world relations, if we were multilingual, we'd have a lot less problems in life. And if American Sign Language or a signed language was accepted as a legitimate language to learn, bilingualism or multilingualism would solve deaf people's problems, basically.
Eventually, Ildefonso got a job, and he left the school where you were teaching, and you ultimately left town. And then 9 years went by before you saw him again. When you did get back together, what had happened with him during that time?
He became a legal resident. He had several part-time jobs, but he was given a job that gave him some creativity and independence, which I think he liked very much. He became a gardener for a wealthy institution, and it wasn't just maintaining gardens, but actually creating them. And it wasn't just that he had a good-paying job or a job where he could be proud of his work, but that he knew what it meant, that he was now a part of the world. He knew what it meant to be a legal resident. He knew what it meant to be on one side of the border versus the other. He was now a part of the world, a part of the human community. And he was very, very proud of his job, And I got the feeling that it wasn't just, as I said, being a part of this job, but now he's a part of the human family.
Did he ever say anything to you about what this whole acquisition of language meant to him?
He does say that his whole world has changed, and he, for one thing, knows that there are answers to his questions and that he can ask questions. And he mentioned to me that he, when he gets a chance to have someone interpret the news, he has them interpret the television news for him. And he has also said that it's very difficult for him to think back to what it was like. He has changed. Language has changed him. And he can no longer think the same way as he did before.
Susan Schaller, thanks so much for coming by today and talking with us.
Thank you.
Susan Schaller's new book is A Man Without Words. She spoke with Fresh Air producer Amy Salad. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. We've had indictments in Los Angeles of the police officers who were seen in that videotape to be beating someone that they were attempting to arrest. And we'll have an interview with a lawyer who has just gotten a substantial judgment from the city of San Francisco for a similar kind of police violence also captured on videotape. Secretary of State James Baker is in Moscow meeting with President Gorbachev. We're going to have a piece from Danny Zwerdling on Liberia, a situation which he says is in chaos. And we'll have the latest news from Iraq.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Class Action is a new courtroom drama that opens this weekend, but film critic Owen Gleiberman says it's the family drama in the film that's most gripping.
When a talented actress looks like a fashion model, she often ends up cast as the girlfriend. That's been the case with Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio. From the moment this sensual, wavy-haired beauty made her screen debut, playing Tony Montana's proud younger sister in Scarface, she seemed a sharp and appealing actress. But in movies like The Color of Money, The January Man, and The Abyss, her appeal has been squandered, diminished. I'd just about forgotten how good she was until I saw her in the engrossing new courtroom drama, Class Action. The movie stars Gene Hackman and Mastrantonio as Jed and Margaret Ward, father and daughter attorneys who end up arguing opposite sides of a corporate negligence suit. Jed is a noted activist lawyer from the 60s, a kind of William Kunstler, Ralph Nader figure who specializes in little guy against the system cases. Jed's a great attorney, but his dedication to his clients can't mask the egocentric pleasure he takes in playing the great legal savior. Nor can it cover up the fact that he was a philanderer who all but ignored his family. Margaret, in rebellion, has become the most ruthlessly successful corporate lawyer she can. The case in question involves an auto manufacturer that may have knowingly allowed a dangerous model on the road. Jed's client is a man who suffered crippling injuries when one of the faulty cars blew up on him. Margaret, who's angling for a partnership in her firm, has a chance to become defense attorney for the company. But Jed isn't exactly thrilled with the idea.
Margaret, don't you see? They're using you as a parlor trick. They think I'll look across the courtroom, see my precious daughter, and just go all soft
inside.
No,
I think it's a bit more than that.
You think, Margaret? You're an associate at Quinn Califan.
So?
They pop out baby lawyers like you like a shark grows teeth, row after row after row, forever. When it comes to the crunch, they'll listen in the big boys.
They already did.
You mean you?
Did it ever occur to you that I might be a very good attorney?
Well, you damn well better be. I raised you.
No! Mother raised me! You had a date!
Class Action has a conventional, even hokey, premise. The movie uses all the familiar tricks of the courtroom genre, and we can pretty much guess where the case is heading. What holds us is the texture of the legal process and the way that Hackman and Mastrantonio play off each other. Margaret's frightening single-mindedness about the law has, in its way, descended directly from Jed's leftist passion. She's very much her father's daughter. We can sense the tension between her ripe, happy grin and her hyper-assertive professional style. At times, she's like Julia Roberts as a career superwoman. And with the right part, Mastrantonio, too, could become a major star. Hackman, once again, takes a no-big-deal role and brings it a bit of magic. He paints Jed's flaws vividly, making the character's heroism seem all the more human. It helps that the business with the auto company is believable in most of its details. Class action gives you a sense of how ethical breaches, in both business and the law, are less a matter of evil machinations than of minutely cut corners. The movie is melodramatic enough to get you rooting for the honesty of these two lawyers, but it's also realistic enough to suggest that attaining justice is almost always an uphill battle.
Owen Gleiberman is film critic for Entertainment Weekly. Well, I'm heading off for a week's vacation. While I'm gone, you'll hear from a familiar voice. Our host will be Frank Browning, who's on leave from NPR. We close Fresh Air with appreciation for the man who left us such memorable songs as This Magic Moment, Save the Last Dance for Me, I Count the Tears, Teenager in Love, Marie's the Name, Little Sister, and Lonely Avenue. The great rock and roll songwriters have never been as well known as the singers they've written for, and Doc Pomus never had the public recognition of the performers who made his songs famous, performers like Elvis Presley, The Drifters, Ray Charles, and Dion. But among musicians and serious rock and roll fans, he was a beloved figure. Doc Pomus died yesterday of lung cancer at the age of 65. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Lorene Carey tells us what it was like to be a young black teenager from the city, recruited into one of America's richest, oldest, and previously all-male prep schools. I'm Frank Browning. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.